Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the Center for Faith Studies on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Frank Schaefer, author of more than a dozen books, including Crazy for God, Sex, Mom, and God, and Keeping the Faith, a father-son story about love and the United States Marine Corps. The topic of his lecture will be The Case for Spirituality in the Age of Doubt. Mr. Schaefer has appeared on the Fox News Network, NBC's The Today Show, CNN, and ABC's 2020, and has been a commentator on NPR's All Things Considered and for PBS's NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, January 26, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Center for Faith Studies, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to speak on the topic, The Case for Spirituality in the Age of Doubt, is our guest, Frank Schaefer.
Let me read you briefly from the prologue of Sex, Mom, and God, because it is a good shorthand way of me telling a little bit of this story and also letting you know that the book is out there. And putting it, a writer tends to put things better sometimes in writing than in words. So let me, well, it's in words, but you know what I mean. I'm going to sign the rest of this talk, so I hope you brushed up on it. One of the things I love most about being with my grandchildren is that they only know me now. So before I explain why I had sex with an ice sculpture and how my family helped push the Republican Party into the embrace of the religious right, and chronicle my family's complicity in several murders, let me say that my granddaughter Lucy has just turned 2. She, along with my 3 other grandchildren, is my second chance, now that I've carved out a spiritual identity, as dramatically eclipsing of my former self as if I disappeared into a witness protection program. My 4 grandchildren, Amanda, Benjamin, Lucy, and Jack, notwithstanding, I'm still prone to label people and ideas as my mother labeled them. Mom divided everything into very important things, and by the way, these things are capitalized in my book, say Jesus, virginity, Japanese flower arrangements, lust, see-through black lingerie to be enjoyed only after marriage, and everything else, say those things that barely registered on my mother's to-do list, like homeschooling me. So I'll be capitalizing some words oddly in this book, such as sin, God, love, and girls, and also words like him when referring to God. I'm not doing this as a theological statement, but as a nervous tick. A leftover from my Edith Schaefer-shaped childhood, and also to signal what loomed large to my mother and what still looms large to me. Blessedly, Lucy and Jack live only a few hundred feet up the street. I walk to their house every day and collect them for playtime. When it's Lucy's turn, she perches in my arms and talks to me. Jack is 6 months old and pulls my nose and laughs a lot, but isn't saying much yet. Lucy likes to be carried when we stroll back to Ba and Nana's house. I'm Ba, and my wife Jeannie is Nana. Lucy's big brown eyes scan the 18th century clapboard houses of our New England neighborhood to see which of the ubiquitous American flags are wrapped around there above the front door flagpoles by the wind, Ba, and which are waving free in the ocean breeze. When we get to my house, Lucy commands me to read The Tale of Two Bad Mice by Beatrix Potter. It is a story about 2 deluded mice, Hunka Munka and Tom Thumb, who mistake a dollhouse dinner laid out in a dollhouse's miniature dining room for real food. When they discover that the lovely-looking ham, fish, and pudding can't be eaten, they smash up the plaster food in revenge, and then spitefully ransack the dollhouse. When she wrote the book in 1904, Potter couldn't have known that her classic story would someday be an allegory aptly illustrating the delusions suffered by members of the American religious right. Some people who helped lead that movement, including me, were very much like Hunka Munka and Tom Thumb. We lived lives informed by beliefs that were not based on fact, and that led to deep-seated resentments that couldn't be cured because what we resented never actually happened. We took it as a personal insult that the real world didn't conform to the imagined facts that we'd been indoctrinated to believe in, and so we did our share of smashing. My late father, Francis Schaeffer, was a key founder and leader of the religious right. My mother, Edith, was herself a spiritual leader, not the mere power behind her man, which she also was. Mom was a formidable and adored religious figure whose books and public speaking, not to mention biblical conditioning of me, directly and indirectly shaped millions of lives. For a time, I joined my dad in pioneering the evangelical anti-abortion religious right movement. In the 1970s and early 1980s, when I was in my 20s, I evolved into an ambitious, successful, in quotes, religious leader instigator in my own right. And I wasn't just dad's sidekick, I was also mom's collaborator in her mission to, quote, reach the world for Jesus. I changed my mind. I no longer ride around saving America for God, nor am I a regular on religious TV and radio these days. Nevertheless, like those two bad mice who later felt remorse and so put a crooked sixpence in the doll's Christmas stocking to pay for the damage they'd caused, I'm determined to acknowledge the destruction I contributed to before Lucy grows old enough to inherit the vandalized dollhouse that she'll soon discover lurking beyond her childhood horizon. So that's how that book starts. But I want to add something in an author note, a little paragraph from the prologue, because this sets up the paradox we'll be talking about tonight. The paradox is that, of course, I fault fundamentalism, all fundamentalisms, for any kind of absolute certainty. And with absolute certainties go blanket generalizations. And that's a two-way street, because progressive Christians and non-Christians and atheists and agnostics and other people tend to generalize about their opponents and about their own faith with as much absolute certainty sometimes as the very people they're criticizing for absolute certainty. So this is one of those things that is kind of contradictory. But a good proof of this is one of the threads that runs through Sex, Mom, and God is the story of my mother, who, as I say in the book, was a much better person than her theology. And in a way, and I don't mean this in any sense to diminish her, but to build her up, she was blessedly hypocritical, because she treated people so much better in person and in life than her theology would have warranted if she had followed absolutely the beliefs she said she believed. For instance, how she treated gay people. And so, interestingly enough, my mom's now 97 and has short-term memory loss and macular degeneration. She will not read this book, but I visited her not this Christmas, but last Christmas while I was working on the book, finishing it up. I read her portions of it. I told her about all of it. And in those conversations, she was very present. And I just want to read you something to show you the paradox of, okay, the Schaeffers were this, that, and the other when they were right-wing activists. But let me read you this little thing to show you that my mother was quite exceptional, and was not the person that you would think. And this book does not have a bitter note in it in terms of saying, oh, you know, my parents did this and that. It's actually, I hope, a very loving tribute to her. I'd like to say this about my mother. At age 96 and suffering from short-term memory loss and sight loss owing to macular degeneration, sadly, Mom won't read this book. But just before Christmas of 2010, we sat down together during a week-long visit, and I told her about my project in detail, including that I was going to tell the truth and let the chips fall where they may. With a flash of her old self and familiar defiant head toss, Mom said, "Go ahead, I don't care what people think," and I never did. Given her memory problem, I should add that before it developed and before her eyesight failed, she read my other equally scandalous writing, including my novels and nonfiction works, which also drew heavily from memories to some people that might have seemed too private to share. Mom isn't some people. I once got a letter from one of my mother's followers telling me that having just read my novel Portofino, which is, by the way, still in print, doing fine, a work of humor where the mother character Elsa Becker is like my mother in some ways, she was sure that it would, quote, kill your mother because of the hatred for Jesus that drips from your satanic pen. You can write me nicer letters if you like. Coincidentally, that fan letter, received in the early 1990s before I was using email, arrived in the same post delivery as a note from Mom asking me for another dozen copies of the hardcover that she wanted me to sign so she could send them to her friends. Mom's follower had signed her letter, "Repent." My mother signed her note to me, "I'm so proud of you." So that goes to show that when we come to these terms we use, like fundamentalist, progressive, you know, I know open-minded liberal fundamentalists who are sort of neo-crypto-fascist brutes, and I know in the way they treat people, and I know some fundamentalists whose ideas, if you saw them listed, you would run a mile, but you would be so fortunate to be stuck on a desert island with them because they're not only fine human beings, but they exude compassion, tolerance, and decency to people around them. So let's just start by saying that this is not a talk that is going to be about slamming my background as if somehow I know anything tonight more than I knew then. I have a different opinion. I know less now than I knew then. And that's one of the changes in my opinion, is a lack of certainty. I think the process of learning and going away from fundamentalism is that every day you get up, you know less, you hope more perhaps, but you certainly have less trust in your knowledge. You get more, I think, of an accurate picture of what the human condition is. We're very small things. We're clinging to a tiny grain of sand floating in an immense multi-universe, and we know less every day, which is why they're running all those tests again in CERN in Geneva, near where I grew up, to try to figure out if those particles really did get to Italy faster than the speed of light. Or as my son, who's very into physics, said, "Yeah, but the Swiss may have sent the particles, but the Italians were taking the measurements." I like Italy. It's my favorite country. My first novel is called Portofino, so no disrespect to Italian people, but it's a pretty good joke. So my childhood, in terms of my experience of God, began with embarrassment in terms of conscious life, because my earliest memory, speaking of my dear mother, was her very long graces that she said at the table where we went on vacations to Italy, which in those days, believe it or not, was the cheap vacation, a four-hour train ride from Switzerland. And my parents had this very humble ministry, became well-known later, but at that time was a Presbyterian minister running this little ministry. Literally, we had a meatless diet most of the time, not because we were vegetarians, but because my parents couldn't afford to feed the students anything but immense quantities of casseroles, et cetera, et cetera. So for me, a piece of grilled chicken in the pensione where we went was a big treat. But my mother had this habit of using prayer as a witnessing tool to all around her. And so while the Anglicans from England who came on vacation there, including a very pretty little girl by the name of Jennifer, who was my age at 11, and the Italians and so forth, the Italians would sort of make their sign of the cross, or if they were in the Communist Party, do nothing and just pour wine. And the Anglicans, of course, would say no grace at all. And my father explained this by saying it was called C of E, Church of England, because it meant Christmas and Easter, which is the only time these people go to church. Our family was graced by my mother's long prayers, spoken loudly and simply so that the foreigners around us would understand what she was saying, because it is our only opportunity to share the gospel, and someday we will give an account for each one of them here. Dear Heavenly Father, we just thank you that you exist and that you sent your son to die for us, et cetera, et cetera. So I would watch the olive oil roll from the olives into my antipasti, my pastini and brodo grow cold, the fettuccine congeal, and everybody else is tucking in. Of course, I shouldn't have been watching. You're supposed to have your eyes shut. The beginning of my faith journey is one of intense embarrassment. People get embarrassed by their parents no matter where they are. But most people settle for, you know, a strange uncle or someone runs for the bus or whatever. But I was in the middle of a sort of an evangelistic rally and had not volunteered to join this crusade. And most kids, as your experience will bear witness to, you know, you don't want to stand out at a certain age. You just would like to have the ground swallow you if you're going to be weird, especially if there are other kids you're trying to be cool in front of. There is nothing cool about this. Having an American mom praying loudly in an Italian pensione on the Riviera in 1963. This is when Fellini's making movies like La Dolce Vita. But you're not doing any Dolce or Vita. You're just praying over your food. So that's my introduction to a public witness. How odd, fast forward, that at age 18, 19, I got Jeannie, my girlfriend, pregnant when we were 17 and 18, and we've been married 42 years now. I don't know who those kids were, but we're very happy together with these children and grandchildren. But soon after that, when I was in my early 20s, all of a sudden, kind of like the North Korean leadership, I followed in that path of nepotistic succession, where you may not have inherited the call, but you have inherited the mailing list. And it seemed like a good idea at the time. And so a gentleman by the name of Billy Zioli came to LaBrie, who was at that time the president of Gospel Films in Muskegon, Michigan. And he and I cooked up a project called How Should We Then Live, which became a film series and a book that took this obscure American theologian living in Switzerland, who was very cool. People came, like your pastor here came and stayed for a little while and talked to him. But all of a sudden, there were all these evangelicals in America running around, and Billy Graham was stopping by, and all these other people would come to, quote, sit at Dad's feet. But even then, he wasn't so much involved in politics. If you read his earlier books, Agree or Disagree with the Theology, it wasn't all about who you vote for or a litmus test of social issues. It was your view of Jesus Christ and the divinity of Christ and the Trinity and philosophy that, you know, Kierkegaard and these people had missed their way and the gospel was the answer. But it wasn't politics. Then Roe v. Wade came along in 73. And I know this sounds flippant, and it isn't this flippant, and I tell the story better in Crazy for God, but one of the reasons we made that film series is I needed another job after How Should We Then Live? And that basis of the evangelical pro-life movement is twofold. It's that we made that film series with Dr. C. Everett Koop, who then became Ronald Reagan's Surgeon-in-Chief. I was then, you know, in my mid-20s. Now what am I going to do? We just finished this other series, and I had gotten a taste for this. Borrowed Jerry Falwell's jet, go around America, talk to huge venues, big honorarium checks, et cetera, et cetera. Dr. Dobson gave away 150,000 copies of some evangelical screed I wrote called A Time for Anger. Two little kids, plenty of money. Okay, this is what I'll do. Very easy, you know, to mistake it for God's calling when it's a well-paid job. And there's them, there is money in them thar hills, believe me, as an author since. You know, I was selling evangelical stuff by the pallet load compared to what my novels will sell for now, and I actually earn a living as a writer. I do okay. I'm fortunate. But that level of sort of commerce and religion is something that just boggles the mind unless you've been there, done that. But I got very deeply involved, and As I got into this, as I tell the story in Crazy for God and this God trilogy, gradually became less and less happy with my lot in life, but for an odd reason that my wife actually identified as we talked about it during the time. And that was, I was very good at it, and I was very successful at it, and Pat Robertson offered me my own show down there at whatever his organization's called. And I'd been on the 700 Club half a dozen times and gone to ORU and talked and then gave a speech at the Southern Baptist Convention to 23,000 pastors. And I've never seen so much blue polyester in my life. This was the 70s. Double stitch suits. I was wearing a double stitch suit. Everybody wore a double stitch suit. Don't laugh. We all did it. And so I was on this sort of roll. But, see, that La Dolce Vita experience in Italy had stuck, and I'm being serious. I wanted to be an artist and a filmmaker, and I had regarded this stuff I was doing with my dad as a stepping stone to what I wanted to do. And then, all of a sudden, it became a whole deal. At that time, I was sincerely an evangelical Christian. I was not a flake. I wasn't pretending I believed these things. I did. It's the only world I knew. I had been raised to believe this, indoctrinated, if you like, living in a tiny commune, being homeschooled as an American in Switzerland, in a village in Switzerland, which was even small for Switzerland, in a country that is to Europe what we were to our village, a cuckoo, you know, Russian doll within a doll within a doll. It's the only world I knew. And the last year that I lived in Europe, in 1978-79, that last period, I was away from home 6 months, traveling around the U.S. speaking, with two little kids at home, and just for practical reasons, Jeannie and I talked and said, this is ridiculous. Either I have to give up what I'm doing in the States or find some way to earn my living in Europe. Well, Europe is not full of right-wing evangelicals who want to hear what I had to say. So God led us to the States. But splitting the difference halfway, Jeannie had grown up in San Francisco, an original San Francisco hippie princess, you know, nice liberal Roman Catholic parents who had thought she had gone out of her mind. She went to Europe for 10 days and came back 10 years later, having gotten saved in Labrie and stuck around and had babies and the whole bit. And so we located on the East Coast so I could get places easily, quote unquote, like, you know, with my great contacts down in Lynchburg, Virginia, and the 700 Club and blah, 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 blah. And we had liked Boston. And we figured we would just live in this nice little North Shore, liberal, happy neighborhood and kind of pretend we were regular people, then sneak off and do far right-wing things. But the very fact that we kind of chose that little neighborhood, not the Bible Belt, you know, and that people were inviting us to do Bible Belty things and we didn't do them, goes to show that I'd always sort of kept this thing in my head of like, I'm not quite there. But then a very curious thing began to happen. See, I didn't know America at all, even though I'd probably been in every state, because if you go to a country and all it is airport, limo, hotel, limo, airport, and the only people you meet are people like you, no one ever disagrees with you, but they run up in airports and grab your hand and say, I just wanted to touch a Schaefer, because my dad wasn't available to touch, or they would all gone there. That's not America. That's just like a Chinese diplomat visiting for a week. He hasn't been here. He's just been to the airport, New York, the UN back and home. He never saw the country. But when I moved into an ordinary American neighborhood and my neighbors were gay and my friends were liberal Democrats and the kind of people I liked were not like me, and I, at the same time, was starting to get to know Jeannie's parents better and visiting them more in California, this country that we had been describing as the kind of harbinger of the Antichrist and these people who were our enemy, all of a sudden it was as if you had lived on the moon your whole life and you came to Earth and you had been told there were no trees and rocks and grass and it was going to be just like the moon, and you got there and said, no, no, it's actually very different here. And all these people we've been writing off as horrible and different and evil are not only nice, but I think they're smarter than we are. And they're certainly more pleasant than the people I'm hanging around in Lynchburg and all the rest of it, who turned out to be a mixture of power-hungry lunatics, absolute flakes, money-grubbing in a context that just blew me away, because my father was many things, but he was not a flake. This is a guy who didn't even have an office in his house, but worked on a little rocking chair next to his bed, and didn't hire a secretary, always flew coach. And all of a sudden, we're in Jerry Falwell's borrowed jet doing a 17-city tour. We're staying in hotel, you know, 4- and 5-room hotel suites at the top of every big hotel. That's where you sort of get put. And it's basically, you come from this background where you're serving Jesus by saying a loud grace so that the Anglicans at the table next to you can invite Jesus into their heart. And you go from there to having meetings with the Bush family and Jack Kemp and Ronald Reagan and all these others. And you're strategizing on how to bring that block of people to vote for Republicans, because the Republican leadership are saying, we're with you on this issue of abortion. And you wake up one morning and you realize they don't care about our issue anyway. The people I'm working with are thieves, flakes, and it's a horror show. The closer you get to this, it's more and more the Groucho Marx phenomena of, I would never join a club that would have someone like me for a member. You realize that you're turning into one of these people, and you always wanted to be Federico Fellini's younger, dumber brother. And it doesn't compute. So people say, oh, well, why did you get out, as if I had some theological epiphany that, you know, I reread the book of Exodus and came to another conclusion. It's nothing to like that. I just got to know Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson really well personally. And essentially it was like this world. And one day I actually said to my wife, and this is true, you know, Jeannie, I said in about 1983, if we ever win, because it was already the we, they, Sarah Palin model of American history, the good guys and then the real Americans and then the enemy. I said, if we ever win and they find out what I really think about anything, including the art on my walls or the movies I enjoy, the first people they're going to put up against the wall and shoot is me. And I really believe that. I don't mean I was paranoid about being shot, but in terms of the analogy, it is accurate. So crisis of faith doesn't really even begin to describe this. But I'll tell you what did sort of begin to change my mind, and that was I realized that I was putting my children either in public schools or homeschooling them or in liberal, secular schools, and you kind of vote with your feet. I didn't want my kids growing up in this environment. So what does that say about a cause you're fighting for that you don't want your children anywhere near? I mean, this is how drug dealers operate. You know, I don't sell in my own neighborhood. Something like that. And so I had this kind of sense that somehow I had woken up as from a very deep sleep, because I'd been sort of anesthetized and raised in this, and just looked around one day and said, you know, where the hell am I? What is this? And it was the opposite of a crisis of problems. It's when I've never earned more money than I earned in those years. I don't mean in adjusted dollars. I mean never. If you adjust the dollars, it would be astronomical. I've never flown first class since. I've never had anybody's private jet since then. It was as if it was a kind of a crazy dream world. And it wasn't even about me. It's just because I was my father's son. I mean, how flaky can you get? It's just insane. So all of a sudden, I'm the keynote speaker at the National Religious Broadcasters. Ronald Reagan's giving a speech on, you know, the next afternoon on the same platform, and I'm standing there talking to him. And, you know, this is just, it was crazy. It was like I said, going to another planet. Then my dad died in 1984, and I really had a choice, because then people came up and said, now the mantle, all this crazy talk, you know, the mantle has, you know, past, blah, blah, blah. So you're going to, of course, be continuing all this. And people sort of gathered around this. And I found every time I came back off the road from these meetings, everything was getting worse and worse in my own marriage. I was turning into, you know, a real jerk, angry with my wife, angry about everything, angry with my children. I hated the work I was doing. I felt like a whore because I didn't believe it anymore. Now, when I'm saying didn't believe it, I'm not talking about a big theological deal. I just didn't believe in this life. I knew we were ripping people off at that point, because I knew the people that I was standing up where didn't believe a word of what they were saying. I knew Ronald Reagan had legalized abortion in California because he believed it should be legal, and he had changed his mind, just like Mitt Romney has conveniently suddenly found Jesus. Because that's who we needed to be. And I knew that the evangelists we were working with were not bad people. They were the worst people I'd ever met in my life. And I mean that from the aesthetic point of view, too. You would just have to burn their houses down if you got inside. I mean, there'd be nothing you'd want. Materialism, the word materialistic, doesn't come close to the inside of the big evangelistic machine. You haven't lived until you've seen, you know, you've been in the basement office in a ministry with somebody like a Jack Van Impe or an Ernest Angley or whatever, and literally seeing the cash being scooped off tables and put in people's pockets, not even counted, that comes in. Okay? It's nuts. So even on the aesthetic level of where do I want my kids around, you know how there are Hollywood directors that raise their kids in Wyoming because they don't want their kid to be raised in Beverly Hills, because even if they do it, they know they don't. They love their child enough to not want to pass this on. That's what happened to me. I wanted to raise secular, educated, north of Boston, decent human beings who had more ambition in life than making a buck off gullible people who just fell off a lumber truck and didn't live a double life. So everything, and so I was walking around behind venues like this, but believe me, in those days there were a lot more people out here. Literally, sometimes we'd be in big things that would, like, had big athletic events in them. I can remember Tom Landry and Roger Staubach coming up to introduce me at the deal we did in Dallas, and it was in some huge thing, and they'd had a big athletic competition. There were ropes back there, and I actually looked at some of the ropes they'd been using for some gymnastic thing, thinking, you know, I'm just going to hang myself. I'd rather hang myself back here than go out and give another talk to a crowd full of rich evangelicals in Dallas that I have nothing in common with in terms of a philosophy. Homophobes, racist, money-grubbing, lots of good people too, all mixed in. Ordinary good folks who are being taken for a ride by these leaders who are making a pile of money, etc. And so I just got to it. And the very fact that everybody wanted me to do this for the rest of my life, when my dad died in 84, in 85, I just shut the door on what was called Schaefer 5 Productions. We had $3.5 million in the bank, which was a budget for a new series we were going to do, and I had the office send the money back to our donors, believe it or not. We literally just called the day on it, fired everybody, and I changed my phone number, and I literally, from one day to the next, in 85, I was out. So it wasn't a crisis of faith as a crisis of identity. Like, I can't do this the rest of my life. Whatever this is, I cannot do this. Not because I'm a good person, probably just because I'm a snob. And I didn't want to hang around these sorts of things. I still wanted to make that movie. So, but when my dad died, and because of this other crisis, then I began to actually ask questions I'd never asked in my life before. What is the basis for all of this? What does it mean to follow Jesus? Does it mean a billion-dollar publishing business? Does it mean private jets? Does it mean taking people for a ride on social causes you don't even believe in because that's where the fundraising is? So we picked on abortion last year. Let's do gays this year. Does it mean a literal interpretation of the Old Testament where if you lose your virginity before marriage, you should be stoned to death in the gates of your father's house? Do I believe this stuff? And it was, you know, Rip Van Winkle waking up, except a different sort of version. So, Crazy for God, Sex, Mom, and God, Patience with God, talk about this journey out and talk about what I came to. You would think that having had that experience, I would have been burnt out enough so that that would be the end of any kind of religious involvement or witness in my life. But it didn't happen that way. And it didn't happen because I think of who my parents actually were, especially my mother, in this blessed hypocrisy. Because I had seen an example in her life of, I think, what actually Christianity looks like in action. It wasn't on the intellectual side, and it certainly wasn't this big deal we got into in the last 7-8 years of my parents' lives that I kind of cruised along with for a couple of years after they were gone, or my dad was gone. It had to do with how they had treated people back in the day when nobody was famous and it wasn't all a big happening commercial enterprise. And that part had stuck. That part had stuck. Watching my mother clean up vomit at 3 a.m. from a drug addict on our kitchen floor. That stuck. Seeing the 16-year-old girl she brought into the house who lived with us for 2 years, and mom said, you can stay with us as long as you need. And she lived with us for 3 years and had her child and took care of her. That pro-life message stuck. My dad, in 1959 or 60, before anybody was talking about this, when a group of African students came from Sofia College, which was one of the communist states that would bring Africans in and give them scholarships to hopefully indoctrinate them and send them back as communist agitators. But because Switzerland was neutral, they could get a little pass to our country for a small holiday, and they came to Le Brie for a couple of weeks. And Dad telling my sisters at that time, and remember, this is 1961 or two. By the way, I just want it on the record that if one of my daughters falls in love with an African man, a black man, it's fine with me. And I know there are Christians back in the States who don't feel that way, but I want you to know that that would be okay with me, out of the blue. See, that's the flip side. That's actually why my parents' ministry had grown. It wasn't the intellectual ideas. It never was the fundamentalism. It was who my parents were as people. And they reached out to people. So what a disconnect with this thing that Dad and Mom and I and the rest of us stumbled into, this high-powered conveyor belt we got on that just whisked us off to another planet of the religious right, because my dad and I had these questions about abortion, and then we made the film, and then I wanted to get ahead, and various things mixed in, good motives and bad motives, and suddenly we were off. But when Dad died, I kind of rethought this stuff and got out. And the first thing that happened is Jeannie and I went broke, literally. We had an enormous crash in thing, but it was at least a sane, you know, we felt sane. I got into the movie business, having cut a reel out of these films and made four eminently forgettable movies that if you really look for them at 2 a.m. somewhere, you may see feature films. The last one was something called Baby on Board for ABC with Carol Kane and Judge Reinhold, and then a couple horror films and slasher films, and I lived in Africa for a year. So I did whatever I had to do to earn a living out of films. I wasn't very good at it. And then my wife one day said, you know those stories you tell about your mother and those long graces in Italy, because she was saying, what sort of movies would you like to make? And I said, well, I'd like to, you know, make movies about my crazy childhood, not documentaries, but features. She says, well, you ought to write the story down. So I wrote Portofino, and lo and behold, it actually got a great review and in the Los Angeles Times, and then it went from there, and it's been successful enough to give me permission to write about another dozen books, real books, not the evangelical screeds for propagandized people who are just want to touch a Schaefer, but people who actually read books and appreciate them as books. And so these nonfiction books are part of that, and some of my novels are part of it, et cetera, et cetera, and the blogging and some of the newspaper stuff. So I eventually found a way to earn a living as a writer, and that's what I've been doing since. But in terms of the spiritual journey, sometimes people ask, how can you, Christopher Hitchens, before he died about 2 years ago, and I had a couple of emails, and he kept saying, you know, given what you're writing in these books like Crazy for God, I can't understand, you know, why you still have anything to do with these idiots, as he would put it, in his gentle, sort of low-key manner. But so tonight, having given you that story, I want to switch gear and tell you why I have something to do with, quote, these idiots. First of all, remembering my mother, these idiots are not idiots, because I've painted a very dark portrait of the big, high-powered part of the movement. But in that movement, the people who, as it were, pay the taxes, buy the books, and support this stuff are cannot be generalized about. And they're as caught in it, most of them, as I was, and many have not been presented with any alternative. So the first thing is I don't bring a critical spirit to people within fundamentalism, as in write individuals off, because A, I was there myself, so was my family, but B, I know from my background that if you had talked to me before I moved to the States and before I began to look around, I didn't have any alternatives. And you can't blame people that have been raised in a combination of you know, indoctrination camp and play school, and that's all they've ever known. This is all they've ever known. And within that group, there are wonderful people. But in terms of my own spiritual journey, I go to a Greek Orthodox church, not because I am Greek Orthodox in that that will solve our problems. You must now all become something. I just happen to like Byzantine liturgies because it's mostly in Greek, so I can't understand them, which is good. Because it's the words that bother me, I know all about preaching and speaking and so forth and so on. And to me, worship is finding a space to be quiet in and actually not think clever things or even analyze anything, but just be there, which is why I think many of us enjoy singing hymns, for instance, because it takes us to another place. So, and I've kind of overloaded on teaching. It's toxic after a while I'm sermoned out. So they, you know, when people say to me, well, there's no good teaching there, I say, yeah, it's just great, you know. There's no teaching at all. You just do the liturgy, you know, and everybody can bring their own interpretation to it. But I want to tell you why I go to church. Why I go to church. Here's why I go to church. And a couple of you have heard this story, but I'm going to repeat it here. I go to church because I get to take my granddaughter Lucy to church with me, and now Jack. And since Lucy was born, she's in my arms. And we take Eucharist together. And the first time I really understood sort of what I was doing was when I went on a little pilgrimage to Mount Athos and talked to an old monk there when I was still in my Protestant frame of mind, although I was beginning to shift away from that background. And I said, well, how can you give communion, bringing my Calvinist mindset, you know, to this, I said, why do you give communion to newborn infants? They have no idea what this sacrament means. And this old monk looks at me and says, do you? Now, evangelicals supposedly believe in mystery, but then they write theological books to explain the mystery. And then it ain't a mystery. So that was the beginning, about 25 years ago, of a different way of looking at worship for me. And it had nothing to do with analyzing clever ideas or teaching or do I get it right. I've concluded none of us can know anything fundamentally about anything. And we walk by faith and not by sight, and not just in religion, in physics as well. and we're all on the same plane, which is that in 10,000 years from now, nothing we say will be relevant, and whether it's science or religious. And if you go to 30,000 feet, you don't know if you're looking at a liberal congregation, no congregation, you can't even see the buildings because we're a speck. So when it comes to worship, I'm not looking for the correct idea that will save me. I'm looking for a moment of communication with something transcendent that I can't do by myself, because unless you're in community with other people, it's just another way of being introspective and selfish, looking within. And so we line up for the chalice, and I had Lucy in my arms. This is a few months ago. And I was very depressed. I suffer sometimes from depression. Well, perhaps some of you do, too. This life of mine has been interesting, but it's had its ups and downs. and I do a lot of questioning of myself and things I've done. Very practical stuff, like being a very mean father to my little girl when I was an 18-year-old father, completely directionless, ambitious, broke, in living as the son of the guru in the ministry. You can imagine a weird, it was in Jonestown, but in terms of the psychological pressure on a young father who's just had a baby, this is not where you want to be his little girl. And thank God and grace that my daughter Jessica and I are best friends, and there's been tremendous healing there. But, you know, Jeannie, my wife, instinctually was excellent at all these things, but I wasn't. I have a lot of regrets. Harshness, going away from home for 6 months at a time to chase stupid ambition of things that, you know, as John always says after we see a bad movie, there's 2 hours you'll never get back. That's my son, John. But I'm looking at, you know, there's 10 years you'll never get back. And one of the tragedies of my life and one of the blessings is that with Lucy, I actually finally, I'm not saying perfect, but I'm a good grandparent and I have it right. And I literally get this hunger in my soul that I can hardly express, wishing that I could just go back and be that person for a girl to her little age when I was 19 with that first daughter of mine and bring just a smidgen of the wisdom and patience that I have now with these little children. And I was talking at Wild Goose Festival, which I'll be at again this summer, and I would urge everybody here to try to get to the Wild Goose Festival, wildgoose.org online, book a ticket and come down and be with us for a week of music and art and spiritual things, and it's wonderful. And just before I went to that festival, actually the week I went down, I had a little incident with Lucy that illustrated how I had changed in the way that really matters. Forget all these ideas, who's right and wrong, voting and all that stuff. I'll tell you what matters. Lucy is in my house, and I'm with her maybe 4 or 5 hours a day, and she comes over with Jack, and they literally live across the street. And it's the great pleasure of being self-employed or self-unemployed as a writer that I can choose my hours. And so I get to spend a lot of time with her, and something happened, very small, but it really showed me something because of a difference of reaction. I can remember how angry I would get with my daughter Jessica if she did something annoying. Young parent, oh, she's learning this thing and I have to teach her and set her straight and so forth and yell at her and don't ever do this again and so forth and so on. And it just makes me shudder because of how different I am with these little kids. And Lucy was in the other room, and she always wants to have a candle on the table when we eat together. Because we read her all these great children's books, you know, like Beatrix Potter and everything, and so she's sort of having a little bit of a Victorian childhood in terms of aesthetics. And I had gone into the other room, and Lucy insists on silverware and a napkin and the whole bit, and not a paper napkin either, because we treat her as if she's an honored guest, which she's going to have interesting expectations, but that's a different deal. But I'm in the other room, and she calls me Ba, B-A, and I don't know why. I never told her to, but it stuck. And I'm getting something else to bring in to the sun porch where she's sitting with herself and a candle and a little thing, and she's sitting there and eating her dinner, and I hear her go, Ba. And I say, yeah, I'm coming in a minute. Ba. Okay, I come around the corner. She's sitting there, and she's taken her cloth napkin, and just, this is when she was about 2 and a half, and just laid it over the candle. And now everything's going in a nice big blue flame up towards the ceiling. And so I walked over and I said, oh, hi, okay, Lucy, I'm just going to bring you some more whatever I have. I think I got the salad here and everything. And oh, I'll just take this to the kitchen, you know. And I put it in the sink and put it out and went back in. And she looked sort of worried at me. You know, have I done something bad? And I said, No, that's okay. And Bob put it out in the sink, and it's not really such a good idea because, you know, things catch on fire if we put them on a candle. And do you think you'll do that again? And she says, no, I won't do that again. She saw that that was a mistake. It scared her a little. But later, I actually fell into a depression because I was thinking to myself, gee, if that had been Jessica when she was 2 and a half, I would have hit the roof. You're crazy. How can you do this? How could you be this stupid? You could have burnt the house down. Blah, 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 blah. Instead of that, you know, I had a little girl who wasn't frightened, who understood the situation because I explained it to her and said she wouldn't do it again. And we have an entirely different relationship. an entirely different relationship represented to me the other day very poignantly when she told me a couple of weeks ago, very seriously looks at me and says, "Ba, I'm going to marry you." So I said, "Well, that would be lovely. You know, it's when you're three, it's not the time to explain the whole situation." So I said, that's very, very nice that you, you know, you think that. Don't you think you might want to marry somebody else?" "Oh, no." And I said, "Well, why not?" And she said, "Because you're so kind to me." And she's only 3 and a half. Well, the beauty of that is, you know, pat myself on the back, it's all true. The tragedy is I can't get the years back of all the mistakes when I wasn't so kind. And the deeper you love, the more you realize when you have sinned against love and the more vulnerable you are. So I was standing in the communion line. You didn't think I'd ever come back to it, but I actually, I'm better at this than you think. I was standing in the communion line thinking exactly that. And the thought started replaying this scene, thinking, "Wow, you really have learned something. Man, I wish I could get in a time machine and just take back the impatience and the stupidity." And yes, I admitted a couple of slaps that I would cut my hand off if I could take back. Undeserved to a child too young to even be disciplined, just a teenage parent being a jerk. No way to get it back except to do everything you can for the people with you now. Now you know a little better. So I was standing in communion line, and Lucy's always in my arms so much that I'm so used to her being there that I actually, you know, it's just, I'm used to, I don't go up in through this line without this little weight here that keeps adding weight. She's bigger now. And so the line was moving slowly, and I bowed my head and just closed my eyes and was lost in a reverie of depression. Just descended on me. Contemplation and depression. You know, my sins are ever before me. Not even specific things, but just wasted years, stupidity. How long does this journey take before you can learn anything and be a person you'd want to be stuck with? How much is Jeannie put up with and so forth? And very much beat yourself up time for a few minutes. By the way, which is not required to take communion. It just, you can take the sacraments without doing that. But I was lost in this thing and thinking about all these things and really had even forgotten where I was. Really forgotten where I was, even with Lucy in my arms. So I was lost in this kind of dark moment, and suddenly I feel these two little hands on my face. And I look up, sort of startled out of the thing because I was lost in my thoughts. And because Lucy's in my arms, she's turned around and she's put her face 3 inches from mine. So I have this beautiful little 3-year-old girl's face, and she's gazing right into my eyes. Just right into my eyes. And there's nothing written in her eyes except love, absolute trust, and a bond with complete innocence and beauty. And literally this thought hit me, and I'm not one of these super spiritual people who looks for this sort of thing. It hit me, and that is, now you have seen the face of God. Because Lucy only knows me now. She doesn't have the memories of all that learning curve other people paid for. She only knows this kind grandfather. She is a second chance. And I can take all those things I've learned and bring that to the table with her. And I was thinking, that's why I'm in church, because it's all very well to say you're spiritual, but where are you going to do it? Where is the physical place you can stand in line and contemplate? Where is the physical place you can have community so you know when Anamamakis is going to have an operation and help her out, or she can know when you're going down and having a problem and help you out, or you know when some child is born with some sort of anomaly and you can rally around the parents? It's all very well to talk about religion and faith and spirituality outside of church, because we all hate church and we had these bad experiences, so we all leave, and now you're what? You're alone. So standing in that communion line, being provided a liturgical space and forum, as it were, to have a moment of contemplation and sweet union with this beautiful little child who trusts me and only knows me now. She has the man that doesn't lose his cool when you almost burn the house down. This is not the person that others have known me to be. And I have not, you know, suddenly changed everything and so forth and so on, but there's been some progress. But it's happened in the context of community and fellowship with other people, starting with these grandchildren of mine. And so Why do you still have family if you screwed up part of your own family in terms of how you lived at a certain point? Because this is the only place you can have moments like that. Why do you go to church? Because it provides a venue for contemplation. Why do you have community? Because unless you're standing there in that line surrounded by these people who support you, you wind up as that dumb teenage father jerk in some form, even if you're 59, because you're alone and you have no system of accountability, no community to learn from, no place to be inspired by, no one to bring you back onto a better path. That's why I go to church. Do I think because I'm in church I'm saved? No. Because I want to conclude the talk now and open it up for questions by just telling you a little story, another one that a monk told me, that I think is instructive in terms of an alternative view of what salvation is, and that is that I grew up thinking that unless you had correct theology, you couldn't be saved, as in God is really pissed off with you already. But if you get your ideas correct about him and Christ and how this all works, and you go to the correct church and you learn the right facts, maybe you'll be saved. My view is very different now, and it was one expressed by a monk to me. And by the way, the monks have plenty of fundamentalists amongst them too. I'm not saying this is all this great thing that you'll find within Orthodoxy. You won't. You find all over the map. But there's this thread of a patristic tradition who asked me if I had ever heard one of the patristic versions of the interpretation of the story of the prodigal son. And I think it really stuck with me. And he said, well, you know, one of the most ancient interpretations is that the story of the prodigal son really is the illustration that there is no such place as heaven or hell. And that was interesting to me. And he said, and this has nothing to do with progressive or liberal theology or anything like that. It's one of the most ancient interpretations of the parable. The father is, of course, God, the deity. The sons represent all of humanity. One son comes home basically just wanting lunch because he's hungry. It's not really, he's repenting, but he wants something, so it's not even a good motivation. And the other son is angry because he's saying, I've been here the whole time doing the hard work, and now you're helping this guy who just came back because he's hungry. And the only reason he's repenting is for bad motives. And he said, well, look, you know, both sons are in the same place, and they both enjoy equally the love of God. One receives this love with joy, undeserved, complete grace and discovery. The other, because he brings anger and jealousy and barriers to his brother, who he resents. This very same love, which is exactly the same for both sons, appears to this son as hell. And the only difference is how they receive the love. And he said, there's only one place, there's only one cosmos, and we're all in that same condition. And what matters is not belief, because you can never believe correctly, because life's not long enough to know anything, even how to be a good father or grandfather, ultimately. But what you can do is work on the content of your own character, given the journey you've got, so that you will experience everyone's love, whether there's a God or not, as heaven, and return it as love instead of with bitterness. And to me, that is the path of salvation. It's also the path of following Christ, if you're a Christian. And the second little story, which is from the 10th century as well, is that, and I was talking about this today in the interview that we were doing, there was a monk in a 10th century monastic community in the desert in Sinai who had arrived at this monastic place, and most of them hermits were living in caves and so forth. And he prayed that he would be shown which of the elders was truly holy, because only God can see the soul and the heart, and so that he could go to with confidence for spiritual direction as a confessor. And one night the prayer is answered, and his angel takes him, and in his dream he flies him over the monastery in a dream. And this monk is looking down, and he sees all the hermits' caves and various of them praying with their little candle and icon or whatever it may be, and he keeps expecting the angel to point one out. But the angel sails right over this mountain and just disappears off into the desert, and eventually comes to a little town not too far away, and on the edge of the town is a garbage dump. In the garbage dump, there's a woman looking for food. They follow her home to her family, her children, her seven children, ragged children. And the monk says, that's the only holy person with a pure heart and clean hands in here that's available to you. She's the holy person. So the monk in the dream says to his angel, but there's a problem here. A, it's a woman, which is bad news in the 10th century. Second, she happens to live in the pagan, non-evangelized part of town. She's not a Christian. You want me to confess to a woman who is not a Christian and seek spiritual advice from someone who's not a believer and doesn't even know who Jesus is? And the angel says to him, you asked me to show you who is the holy person near you that God has chosen to be your confessor, not someone who you choose. And that's the end of the dream. Now, that's an old monastic story. And it goes back to an era way before anybody heard of Tillich or Niebuhr or any of these other people, and has nothing to do with modern theology or progressiveness. And I end there just to tell you that there is hope within the Christian tradition of a line of thinking that goes back to the very beginning of the church and even into Scripture itself, where you see this same paradox where, yes, there's this harsh fundamentalist version of everything, but the more inclusive and the more forgiving and humane version, the older grandfather rather than the young teenage father, if you want to put it that way, who now sees the errors of his ways in so many ways, has always been there. And so a thought for people who follow a progressive religious tradition, be they Muslims or Christians or Jews, is that the tradition of harshness and absolute certainty has been in every religious tradition from the beginning and produces its own fundamentalists. But within every religious tradition has always been this other view that the mystery of salvation is in the content of character changing, and that the spiritual guidance we get is where we find it. The Spirit, as the Scripture says, bloweth where it listeth. It goes where it wants. There are no, you know, it's not following theological rules. So for me, my spiritual journey has come to something very simple, and that is to be a good grandfather, to lament the past, those 10 years I will never see again, of thrashing around in the fundamentalist desert, in fact making the country a worse place. And things come down to something very individual and personal in spirituality, not the big highfalutin ideas, but really who we are as people. So in terms of my angels and in terms of my guidance and spiritual direction, it isn't theology books now. It's a relationship with a 3.5-year-old, a 1.5-year-old, an 18-year-old, a 15-year-old, my 3 children who are all adults, my daughter-in-law, my son-in-law, my wife, Jeannie, that circle of people. And in that circle, I can find the redemption. And in the circle of my church community, I can find the redemption that eluded me when I was chasing it, trying to have correct ideas about God rather than just working on the content of my own character. And the only place you can work on that is in the relationship with the people around you. They are the woman on the garbage dump that you can have a relationship with that God leads you to because they're in front of you. It has nothing to do with correct ideas. It's trying to be a correct kind of a person, and that's a whole different ballgame. And that, check in another 20 years, and I'm sure I'll regret 9/10 of what I said tonight, but that's the learning curve to this point. Thank you all very much. Thank you for watching.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the Center for Faith Studies on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Frank Schaefer, author of more than a dozen books, including Crazy for God, Sex, Mom, and God, and Keeping the Faith, a father-son story about love and the United States Marine Corps. He spoke on the topic, The Case for Spirituality in the Age of Doubt. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, January 26, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Kugler, director of the Center for Faith Studies, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.